Welcome to The Smiling Fox, a Mythic Bastionland podcast. My name is Horst.
I am Brian.
Hey, I'm William.
Today we want to talk about finishing a campaign. And we have with us an adventure writer extraordinaire with an eye for juicy NPCs, a game designer for solitary nights, and maybe the first person who ever finished a Mythic Bastionland campaign and blogged about it eloquently. Welcome, Amanda P.
Thank you, Horst. Thank you all of you for having me today. I love Mythic Bastionland, and I'm always happy to talk about it, so I'm glad to be here.
Awesome. Maybe start with your adventure design. How did you get into writing adventures?
I first got into writing adventures by spending a lot of time on the NSR Discord in the very early days of like 2020, 2021. I got to know some very kind people there, Yohai Gal, Sam H, among others, who all kind of encouraged me to start creating. Chris Bissett did an adventure jam that was, I can't remember what it was called, and Yohai did one right after. And so it just kind of got me germinating on the idea of running adventures. I'd only started GMing at all in 2020. I'd only ever been a player before that in games. And so I was kind of just exploring what my aesthetic was and the things I enjoyed. First running, obviously, 5e, like a lot of people, after I'd been playing 3.5, Exalted, other games in the past. But as I kind of started discovering this like little kernel of the role-playing game spectrum, I found it to be quite compelling to start to try to create things that I related to on my own. There's a book by Louisa May Alcott called Little Women, where there's a whole thing about how Jo March has to eventually find that she needs to write her own experience or write things that she relates to, as opposed to just writing pulp. That book stuck with me at an early age, and so I find that I always start with the people first and then what's around them. And I think that that's kind of like the general philosophy of how I tend to approach my adventure writing. But speaking generally, I've written several adventures, including three adventures in a setting I call the Tannic Forest, that's heavily modeled on the Pine Barrens of southern New Jersey, as well as I wrote an adventure that's in the Karen Box set called Dread Hospitality. That's my take on a evil manor house adventure. And I am currently writing a Greco-Roman mystery cult inspired adventure, as well as the next Tannic adventure at this time.
Is Beneath the Burning Teeth, was that your first adventure?
Yeah, that was the one I wrote for the Crispus at Jam.
And I remember that it had these really interesting NPCs. Like you gave every NPC a drive. And you talked about designing an adventure from the perspective of the NPCs, of the people first. Is that part of the dungeon and dilemmas? Is that still something that influences you?
So yeah, I wouldn't say that I use it as much now, but I think it was a formative thing for me to read at that time.
Is horror something that interests you? In the Eternal Empress seems to be, you know, pretty dark in themes. And also in Beneath the Burning Teeth, there's this corruption element that where the deeper you go, the more corrupted the players become.
I would say that I am very interested in that as a generative place. I'm not someone who enjoys horror movies, like, at all. I actually greatly dislike body horror especially, and so I think that's why I write about what I think is horrible.
Having an issue with body horror, has that affected how you run the Seers in Mythic Bastionland? Because I feel like there's a body horror
element. There's a lot of body horror, yeah.
Or there can be.
I think when you know why something is horrible, you can really lean into why it's horrible when you're GMing. It's like a delicate dance. Like, for example, in the second realm we ran, because I ran two realms, the second realm we ran, we had the Map Seer, which is just like a flesh mountain, kind of. Which is disgusting. But I just like, you just think about somebody that like leashed that much of themselves away in order to have like a connection with like divine providence and just like, and the unknown magical fey elements of the world. Like they're so changed and unrecognizable that like to them, this is like normal, but to like these like knights who are kind of, it's the thing I like about the game is like there's like the mundane of the knights who have some elements of having been touched by like the fae or whatever, the forest, the dreamers, whatever you want to call it, and then, or the myths. And then there's this other element of these things that have become so far, like unrecognizably transformed that there's like an interesting point of friction there. And so really leaning into like that from a description standpoint, while I have a group I can go pretty hard with because we have had those conversations and lines and veils and all that around safety tools, like they're all down. You can really get into just making this like malicious mountain creature that, because some of the seers are actively hostile, many of them.
They definitely have hostile drives or drives that are counter what the knights would want. Talking about changed, can we talk a little bit about the Pilgrimage of the Sun God? Because all three of us have played the solo game in the last couple of days. What is Pilgrimage of the Sun God about?
To me, Pilgrimage of the Sun God, which is a solo journaling game that I wrote a couple years ago, it's really about failure and moving beyond failure because it's structured for you to fail. Like, it's deliberately written so that unless you roll very well when you're essentially setting your character up, it is almost impossible for you to win without having to break your vows at least once. And so it's about how you can move on and continue your quest with that fall. Because when I was writing it, I read a lot of Arthuriana, including my childhood Arthuriana, which is James Knowles' King Arthur and His Knights.
Is that a work of fiction or is it kind of just like an encyclopedia?
It's a children's classics version of King Arthur, actually. Okay. But it's the first one I ever read. It's based on Mort d'Arthur. I read, I'm going to butcher this name. I'm sorry. I do not speak French. The Chrétien de Troyes. I've read several others. What I kept looking for were like, what are the themes? Like, what are the imagery? And how do you write a game that's about the Arthurian journey, which is often about failure and change? Like, most knights in Arthurian stories fail. Like, Percival and Galahad is like are the only one, especially Percival, has always been so compelling to me. He's my favorite, always, because he making something about having to be courageous and finding courage in a place from a place of failure and like wounding is interesting to me. And it's why I really was excited when Chris wrote Mythic Bastionland, because I was like, I felt like we were, it's like, they're very different. But it's like, how do you create an Arthuriana that is not grounded in Christianity, but is more about like an older folkloric element? And so we were both trying to do very different things, but it's like, when it came out, it was kind of like, this is what I've always wanted from a like an adventure game that's about knights is this.
When you were working on it, were you always from the outset planning a solo game?
It was originally a hack of Cairn. in the very beginning, it was a Cairn hack that was like, I was trying to write a solo Cairn hack, and then it kind of evolved into a very bespoke journey because I was hanging out a lot with like other people who were writing solo adventure stuff at the time. I don't know if any of you are familiar with Armanda Haller. She wrote a really cool book that's about, it's like Blade Runner, where it's like you're a replicant being interviewed by, or not a replicant, you're a person who they're trying to figure out if they're a replicant or not, and you're being interviewed to determine if you are. She's written a ton of solo games that are all really great, but that one, I read it, and I was like, it kind of like opened up a place in my brain for what that could look like.
I think for Beneath the Burning Teeth, that was a randomly generated name, is that true?
Yes.
And you designed the adventure based just on the name.
Which yes.
Sounds a little bit like Spark Tables, right?
Yeah, I like Spark Tables a lot. I got really into them because I've been in like into the odd like and odd adjacent space for a while. And Spark Tables were just very big in this area, I think, of this scene. I mean, we all love K-Tray's, D4 Caltrips, the blogs, incredible D100 tables, but I don't use randomness as much anymore in my design. I don't think randomness has a place in adventure design as much as it, I think it can be overused or unintentionally used. But for solo games or games where you have to do character generation, I think that because we're in a scene that's kind of not really into like character build culture, which is not a statement of judgment, just a statement of truth. Mm. I think that when you allow for more random generation, sparks, things like that, it kind of makes you, it pushes you outside of your comfort zone to create a character that you might not otherwise create. It like unlocks something in your brain.
I'm not a solo player. This was my, I think, third solo game experience. I feel it is difficult to be the referee and the player at the same time. Randomness probably can introduce an element that is out of your hands and that surprises you.
I also struggle with solo games. This is kind of written for how can I focus on a solo game? Because I can't, it's really hard for me to balance being the player and the referee. Like, I've tried so many different methods that people have for it. I haven't tried the Mythic GM emulator, which I know is like the classic. A friend of mine, Symbolic City, wrote this thing. I forget what it's called, but he wrote it, and it's basically around how you can use published adventures as a solo player. And it's really good. I think part of it is I like playing with other people, and so it's hard for me to play solo.
I have a similar issue where it's like I really feed off that energy of someone. You say something random and someone else gives you back the juice, and then you add on top of that, and it's like this back and forth. But I really enjoyed this game as well, because I found that it did give me a lot to work with. Those basic sparks that says do something with this, and you have enough room to play around there.
Yeah, I think it's worth saying, because the listeners of this podcast are at least interested in Mythic Bastionland. If someone's curious about trying solo games, this is a great game to try because it has some of the same DNA to it. I think it's a great introductory solo game because it guides you through failure, which is one of the most challenging parts. The natural inclination for most people seems to be, when you fail, completely destroy yourself and then get frustrated and quit. But this is a game about coming back from setbacks, which is nice. And also the prompts, I think, are very... There's a nice balance between being open and also quite directed. You know, this very specific problem has happened, and it might even indicate to you some hint about how you might solve it, but then gives you the freedom to flesh that out, which I think is really, really cool.
To add on to that, there's a good balance of vague and evocative at the same time, which is, I think, quite hard to do.
One question that leads off it, because Amanda, I think you're very good at writing these sorts of prompting questions. And I'm wondering, does that come into your GMing? Paint the scene type pictures, is that something you use?
I like to use it. I don't use it as often as I would like, because it's like, it's when you're running, I find that you can't always remember to do everything that you would do when you're right. When I'm like firing on all cylinders, yes. But I find it also depends on the people I'm playing with. Sometimes I'll have a table that is like very open to being very generative in terms of adding to the fiction. And then I've played with other groups where they are looking for more direct information. And sometimes you have a group where you have kind of a balance. And so I find that I have to kind of cater to the party that I have at that time.
So when you wrote the blog post about running Mythic Bastionland, you mentioned that you would categorize Mythic Bastionland as a capsule game. Could you explain where that term comes from?
So there's been a couple different writings about capsule games. I could direct you to specific links for that. But essentially, if you're asking me what the definition of it is, I think the intention of it is, it's not a true capsule game in the way that Lady Blackbird is. Like Lady Blackbird by John Harper, you have set characters that you play in a set setting. There's even kind of set scenes to a degree. So Mythic Bastionland isn't prescripted to that degree, but I would say that it is quite directive, and it's like you are a company, you are knights in a realm. It's more open in the sense that the GM like builds the realm, but there are set myths and set knight types, and there's a lot of things are, you don't roll a random character. You don't roll like a bunch of different things to say, oh, this person is a knight that I've made up. You know, like you have these are, the way I played it is there is one of everything. There is one Boulder Knight. And when the Boulder Knight dies, a new person becomes the Boulder Knight.
I have a special rule that when I have a new player come in and they roll a character, a knight that is already an NPC knight in the realm, that NPC will die, and that led to heartbreaking NPC deaths.
Oh, I like that.
You would say that, for example, GURPS is the, or Fate is the opposite of a capsule game because it's like a general purpose machine, whereas something like Lady Blackbird has a very distinctive voice, setting, named characters even. And in Mythic Bastionland, obviously, you have these distinctive knights.
Yeah.
And at least an implied setting. You also mentioned in the blog post the mundane and the mythical, which I'm interested in. If somebody just flips through the book, they will see the 72 myths. They will see maybe 3 pages about politics. But in an actual campaign, how was the ratio between mythical and mundane?
There should be more mundane than you think, because the mythical is only interesting if it is within the context of the mundane. To me, it's kind of like in a horror movie when there's moments of stillness and calm and like gentleness, you know, like there, you have to, the contrast is what makes everything like work.
Yeah, if everything is weird, then nothing is, right? But where did the politics in your campaign come from? Was it spark tables? Was it story or tension that you put in by hand?
So what I did was I made essentially when I was making every single location, dwelling, monument, holding, everything, seer, I rolled every single one of the people tables for every single thing, every location, because it's, if I was making it people based, I made the locations people based too, because the holdings, like you like learn if it has a bailey and whatnot, like if they have an overabundance of grapes and a dearth of I don't know barrels, but like what you really need to make the realm like work is to know who lives there and what do they want. And so if you roll a person, like, and I rolled knights for each of the, like, holdings, and or one was, like, a mayor and not a knight, but, like, for the dwelling, one of the dwellings was, like, a harpist gathering. And so something I rolled was he's, like, gravelly, he has an estranged successor, and his task is to hunt a warband. And so, and then at another location, I rolled that someone had some like degree of like rebelliousness, and so I said, okay, there is a war band that is roaming about the realm and they're causing some sort of mischief, like harassing farms. And then among the myths, I had already rolled the child, and in the child myth there are seeker knights that are seeking the child all across the land. And so it developed, you take those things together, and it developed that one of the lords, a Lord Reinrich in my case, from the Northlands, had sent forth like all of these, like he has knights that are about the land, and some of the who are kind of rebellious, and some of those knights have gotten seduced by the myth of the child and have like deviated from what they were doing, which was like Gregor Clegane's, sorry, that's a Song of Ice and Fire thing, but Gregor Clegane style raiding, and instead they are following this myth. And so that's like a one kind of look at it. And so, but like I rolled every dwelling had a person, every person had a quest, because everyone should need something, and not every, and that way they were often getting pulled between the needs of these individuals and settlements and the overall seeking of the myths. And so they, so the party also had to balance the mundane and the mythical. And so it's like, that's how you, it's like they have a duty as knights to protect the realm, but they also have a duty to seek the myths. And I feel in Mythic Bastionland, you should be forcing knights to choose between their duties. You should be putting that pressure on them, because it makes it, and otherwise it like, what's the point? They have to have risk. There has to be something they could lose.
Did you roll up all these characters as part of your prep, or was it like in session coming up with it?
Mostly prep. I'm not, I am, I, and so I would just like have like a bunch of notes that just say, leader, warm, elegant, gravelly tone, poetic manner. He has a family business with a strange successor, just like the notes from the table. And then that would give me enough. Sometimes I'd be able to write more. But honestly, I tend to be somewhat improvisational, but I did do a kind of something I like to do is draw a kind of map of relationships sometimes. And it's very simple. It'll be like,
did you have like a whole board with like red lines from names to one another?
Yeah, it's like red line. This person hates this person. And it's like, I don't write a lot. It's like hates this. And so it's like, who's connected to the child as the myth? Who's connected to Lady Olympia, who is the leader of this particular realm? And so it's like, it developed into rolling all the tables that all of the lesser lords, because of the crisis of lawlessness in the land, were holding back their troops from Lady Olympia, some of which were raiding. And so because she's older, her circle is older, and they're not doing a good job of protecting the realm right now. And so there's some people who are trying to force her out.
I find it also interesting that you have an initial condition. The lawlessness, was that put in by hand?
I rolled it as a crisis, actually. I looked at the Dominion and rolling a Dominion. And so I rolled a crisis roll at the very beginning. And so I got chaos, lawlessness in the land, enforce a sense of justice. And so I find with this game, it's like the more stuff you roll on, the better it is. It's like, are people broke? You could roll on collections, and then you're like, oh, okay, so everyone's broke, people are not paying their taxes, there's drama at court, and if you just, like, set all that up in the beginning, then this game is very easy to run, because you've already rolled in a ton of tables that kind of just tell you everything that's happening, and you can kind of move your focus to wherever they are, and just kind of develop around them.
But the Spark tables came into the rules relatively late. It was not in Primeval,
no.
As far as I remember. And did you use the blog post where Chris suggested to roll relationships between holdings?
I rolled relationships between holdings, but I cannot remember if it was because of that blog post or before that. Primeval, I didn't. I played in it very early, and I looked at it very early, but it was before the Kickstarter, but I didn't start my campaign until things were further along and it had switched. And I think we were in one of the early PDF versions of the new book, pre-art, when Alec was still drawing all the art.
Just a clarification on your prep. So was it specifically one character you rolled for each location? Or in a holding, were you adding additional characters?
I rolled one character per holding to start, and if it looked like they were going to go there, I would then create more characters to fit there. And so, for example, I had a small, like, castle town kind of thing run by a mayor with a very, very small keep, and in that, I then rolled a couple more characters when I knew that was where they would be traveling. Occasionally, I would roll NPCs if there was like a thing they were going to need to do, like a river crossing. I rolled this like criminal who was stealing from like an abandoned boat, who later built an inn because they kept coming back to her. And eventually, she had enough resources that she built an inn at the crossing where she was ferrying people, like she's an entrepreneur. So, yeah, so I would roll one to start to just be like the character, give me an idea of the character of that location. And then if they were going to be there, I would build it out more. But I tend to not build out. I'm kind of a gardener GM and not an architect GM, to borrow the George R. R. Martin thing. It's like I will kind of see what they're doing and what the character of their quest is, and then kind of just like build out what I think fits within the milieu.
And when you started the campaign, did you give them any sort of initial task, or did you just, you know, where did you place the knights in the realm, and what information did you give them?
I gave them a map that had just the holdings on it. Like, all the images and little were on it in terms of the hex art to spark interest, but I didn't name anything but the three holdings. And then I essentially told them in the realm there had been a noble order of knights that had collapsed into destruction, corruption, that who had been the last group hit that had sought the city long ago. It was the Sun Guard, because it's me and I could do that. There was remnants of the Sun Guard, like sometimes they'd see in the land, but it wasn't like relevant. It was just kind of an Elden Ring kind of thing where it's like, oh, here is this thing that is meaningless for this quest, but just kind of gives the character of the land something older. But I did, here, let me find the thing. I did a campaign one sheet because I do that whenever I start a campaign. It's like a thing I learned from Mike Shea, the Lazy GM guy. Because essentially you say six truths the party would know, who the party is, and then I wrote some questions to bond the various knights together. So what I told them was, I'll just read it to you. You are hedge knights, come to this land, seeking opportunity. Your knighthood's warm as mother's milk and fresh as morning dew. You are the children of spring, your new arms shine in the midday sun. You came to your knighthoods over the long cold winter, called to serve by the seers and sworn to your oaths. Despite whatever burgeoning relationships, good or ill, you may have, you were a company newly formed of foreigners sent to a land unseen by your fathers. And then I stuck them on a boat and I dropped them on a beach.
Awesome. I think this is how you should start. I'm always a bit puzzled if people say, well, I give them a fetch quest so that they know what to do. But it is a sandbox. They tell them that it's a sandbox and that should tell them how to play the game. Which brings me to player buy-in. I think that the game doesn't work if the players don't buy into the premise. If they start looting or being interested in money or something, you can't really run the game. How did you sell the game?
I essentially told them, I was like, it is a game where you are Arthurian knights. It is a game that does not have money. Everything is about relationships and hospitality, like the ways you build relationships with people around you. And they will be willing to do things for you, but they also expect you to barter and do things for them. It's a realm that you don't know. You're expected to explore it and learn and address the myths and seek the seers if you need to learn things. But I don't think I've had a single party not be extremely suspicious of the seers very quickly. But essentially that's what I did. I showed them the game. I told them the thing I read to you and they bought in because I think I mostly surround myself with nerds who are very into Arthuriana. I have had issues with players who get too violent once or twice. And so it's like, I think it's about reminding people like the norms of this world and these knights. Don't get me wrong, real historical knights, you know, brutes with swords to a certain degree. But like, this is presupposing Arthurian knights who hold to a code.
It's Arthuriana through like a romantic lens.
Yes.
Where maybe that element of violence is not as prevalent as in the real world. We talked about capsule games. Mm-hmm. In the blog post, you mentioned that you advise against using other OSR supplements, like drop-in dungeons, monsters, items. Why is that?
I have a lot of opinions on this. and I mean no offense. And I mean no offense to the many wonderful people who use it to run things like London Drum Valley. I think that's great. Like, I think people can have whatever fun they have at their table. And I support that. But for me, I think you lose a lot when you make it a knowable place. I think you lose a lot, especially, I am very against running knights, Mythic Bastion land style knights in a setting that is defined, because it makes it impossible for there to be wilderness in a real way, because most point crawl maps do not, and most hex crawls like that are not this kind, have a presupposition of a realm that has a certain level of order, military style control, like definition of realms with borders. And I think that the whole point of Mythic Bastion Land, in some ways, is that it is about exploration and discovery, which I know can be fraught because of colonialism and whatnot. But in this setting, it's not really about that. It's not about claiming territory. It is about addressing often wounds in the land, myths, you know, that can be caused by myths or by man. And I think unless you make more space between things, it makes it challenging. In terms of other things like dungeons and whatnot, I can be more flexible on that, but I don't think that knights are dungeon delvers. Like, I have played around with it a little bit. Because with, like, exploring sites, in this game, I think can be, you could build that out a little more if you had a group that wanted to explore locations. I tend to like them to be have a little more going on. And so I did incorporate a couple care and procedures for that specifically. But I, in general, I think that this is a game that really sings when you take it where it is. Take it as it is and you run it from the book. And it doesn't mean, and you should do that, I think for any game, you should do that first before assuming that something is missing. But I know that people like to, Yohai is this thing about dials, like people who want to like mess with the mechanics of things, which is great. That's a wonderful way to start being being a creator. But I think, I don't know, I think it's good to take something on its own value so that you can then discover through play, since that's what we're doing here, what you feel is would you'd want to develop in a slightly different vein for your own table. In my case, I wanted to build out sites a little bit, but I only did that occasionally, and it was not, I don't know if the juice was worth the squeeze in doing so.
I read the blog post about the dials. I think Yohai was very skeptical about A, fiddling with dials before you have played the game, but he was also quite skeptical about fiddling with the dials when you want to achieve something that the game doesn't want you to do. So if you take Cairn and introduce skills, for example, you take away kind of the essence of what the game is about.
Yeah.
So we already talked about how you started the campaign and how you created political tension. Did you have houses in your realm?
Not really.
Not really. Or families?
Yeah, yes, to a degree, but it wasn't. I wouldn't say that like their interest was strongly in exploring the wilderness and dealing with the myths for the most part. So it's like anything I did with the holdings or the people had to tied into those pretty directly, and so I didn't really do a lot of family drama, like that kind of stuff with like inheritances and lineage and whatnot. I would do that in a campaign. It just didn't play out in this particular one.
And when you started, did you have a fixed campaign length? Did you talk about beforehand, let's play for 10 sessions and that's it?
It was kind of open-ended. I said, I was like, I'll run for 6 sessions. You can let me know what you think if you're having fun, and then we'll keep going. And then we kept going for like almost 2 years. Yeah. So which is why we ended up doing 2 realms due to the nature of the campaign and the kind of the story that ended up happening.
So what was the narrative behind moving from one realm to another?
So the crisis in realm 1 was caused by a lord in realm 2, which was at the right at the border of the two. I did 2, it's like 12 by 10 or whatever the size is. There was this thing, this tower way to the north called North Beacon that was held by the forces of this man, Lord Reinrich. He essentially, they were having issues with the myth, the dead in the North Realm. And so their realm was having all sorts, like myths were even more a mess up there. And so he was like, if I am still dealing with like this count, she's not doing anything. So they attempted to assassinate her at a tournament, and the knights stopped the assassination attempt. They got appointed to her circle, and then she immediately shipped them north to go deal with to pretend to still be hedge knights and kind of investigate this rebellious lord and all the things that were happening up there.
And was that very driven by player agency, or did you have some, were you kind of steering things a little bit towards that happening? Could she have been assassinated, and then it's like, right, now you need to clean up the mess in this realm?
Yeah, like they could have traveled north, yeah, and that would have been fine too. But it was kind of like, I saw it as like, since they did it, it was a good opportunity to like, they kind of had played through most of the myths that they were the most interested in the first realm. And so I feel like there was like, I could feel like the energy shifting, and I was like, okay, we got to inject some tension into this.
Did you skip ahead by seasons and ages, anything like that?
Oh, did we? Yes. So the wheel was one of the initial myths we had. And so if you're not familiar with the wheel is essentially a myth that causes the seasons to rapidly pass forward and backwards. And it just like, it's the Wheel of Time has gotten stuck, essentially, or the Wheel of Seasons, rather. And so there's things you have to do to, like, address that. But that was the child and the wheel were going at the same time, which was extremely chaotic for me because it meant that, like, every other session, the seasons were changing because they kept getting the same wilderness roles for the wheel specifically. And so the wheel, like, we rapidly went through several wheel season transitions. And so I had to think about, like, what that meant for the realm. And that kind of upped it to, like, two more crises because people were starving because the plants kept growing, dying. There was, like, people were burning through their stores. People aged rapidly, and so, including the knights. Like, they would wake up the next morning and they would have, like, long beards. Yeah, I kind of did some fairy tale logic with that. Like, I didn't make them have starved from being asleep for a season or anything, but I just tried to be like, I wanted it to be visual. Like, and so there would be like flowers with ice frozen on them and like stuff like that.
Oh, cool.
But I think the question was, did the players at some point say, we would like to advance to the next season or we would like to advance to the next age outside of the
wheel? Not really. I mean, we had one phase transition, I think, in the whole thing. Let me look at this.
Did they get from young to mature, for example?
They did. Yeah, we did a jump, I think, in between seasons of the campaign. I think I did a time jump when they went north because it took a while to, like, get things settled down and then travel north because they were on ships all... They went up through the winter ice, and so we kind of made the time kind of pass. It also felt like a good, like, milestone for them to move. And also because so much time had passed with the wheel that it made sense to be able to, and they'd gained enough glory. So it was kind of like, this feels like a good time to, like, up them. But it was I would say it was less player driven than by, like, the nature of the way time passage had happened in the campaign.
Sometimes the narrative kind of suggests that a time skip makes sense now and everybody agrees at the table. Given that you love Arthurian stories, can you see yourself running another Mythic Westerland campaign, and would you do something differently now?
I definitely would run it again. I loved running it. It was so easy to run for me, and it fits naturally with my playstyle, which is, like, I prep to a degree, but I tend to be a pretty improvisational GM where it's like I know how much I need in terms of my notes, and then I can just kind of go. And I think that this game fits that like a glove. But if I were going to do something different, I would want to start with old knights. I think that could be fun to start with. We never did the city quest. Like, we ended with another age jump at the end where people kind of settled and went to do their various things in terms of, like, someone became the marshal of a court. Like, someone else went off in the wilderness hunting somebody who had escaped the party, stuff like that. So I think that I have told them if we get tired of the next two games we're running, we can come back with those characters and have a big time jump. So that is always on the table for that table. And I would re-roll the realm completely, have a lot of time pass, kind of figure out what would have happened in the interim.
But the characters kind of retired. Was that sort of the ending that you gave them?
I would say that they all kind of, like, they're not actively questing right now. They all have other jobs they're doing. Like, a couple of people are training junior knights, and a couple other people are hunting. Someone's serving as a marshal. But yeah, they retired. None of them died.
How did you know that the campaign was over? Like, was it something that you decided as a group? This seems like a logical endpoint.
Pretty much, yeah. We felt like we had played it for a while. There had been a couple people had transitioned out of the game, in and out of the game, and so it felt like this is a good time to stop. If we want to come back to it later, we can. But we were in it. There was, like, interest in just, like, playing something else for a little bit. Honestly, there wasn't a deeper reason.
Let's assume you would pick up the game again with the same players, and they acquire 12 glory. Would you send them on the city quest?
I would think about it. I would, like, seed it out to them, for sure. But, I don't know, the city quest is interesting to me. Because I find that, I don't know, I find that it's, like, quite malicious in a lot of ways. Yes, I would put that out there. I would probably also roll other myths that I would put out there as well to see if they bit on it.
Was the city quest established as something that they want to go. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Because I love that as aspect of the City Quest, that we have an equivalence to the Holy Grail, something that they really want to
be worthy of.
Yeah, be worthy of. Exactly. It's not, I want to get the high score of 12 glory.
Yeah. I think we ended at 6. Yeah. Like they could have started at a 10 at holding.
Just a general question about myths. So the resolution of myths is kind of left to the group. Is this myth resolved or not? Did anything interesting come up there? Were there any times where something went on a little longer than maybe you had omens to support? You know, like you'd done all the omens and the players were like, this is still happening. Did you have any experiences like that? Or anything where they thought it was resolved maybe and you felt like it should still keep going?
The child was very clearly resolved because they brought the child to the, I think, the moon seer, the one who you can only see in a full moon, so that they could, like, a kind of changeling child to be raised there because their family was gone, which felt very resolved to me. The wheel, they gathered the items they needed, and then they had to delve into the wheel was kind of in a windmill, like a strange David Lynchian windmill that they had to navigate. And they were able to get the stuff onto the wheel in order to kind of reset it. So that they resolved for real. Other things they didn't resolve, like the beast is still wandering. But they didn't try to... I don't think they ever tried to like say something was resolved when it was not. So they were kind of harder on themselves than maybe even I would have been. Yeah, because they resolved the dead. I think there's some goodness in a myth that never gets resolved and kind of like you could then have like post myth like damage that myth left, creating a new sanctuary or monument.
Am I right? Did you say that they got 6 glory? I consider my campaign to be progressing with glory quite slowly.
Yeah.
But I think some players, you hear them telling stories and like, you know, they finished 2 myths in this session. In the next session, they're going to try and clear out another 2 myths. And did you feel the pace was fast, slow, or just... That's how the group is.
I found it varied based on whether they were getting tied up in the mundane or the myth seeking. Like if they were dealing with a lot of like court politics type stuff, then there would be long days where they didn't get anything.
All right. So sticking the landing. When you had the last session, was there a clear ending? Did you give them kind of an epilogue opportunity? Or was it, you know, the session is over, maybe we'll play this again?
There was a clear epilogue, because I can't be stopped. I always want to have a clear epilogue. And then one of my players who played a knight called Lancel Markart, he wrote a letter, like a section of a letter his knight wrote to another... one of the other knights, like as a really long multi-post Discord post about it that was just like very good. But essentially the way that the campaign ended, they were on the last omen of the sun, which they had let loose on the land because it was going to Lord Reinmark's fort anyway, because it was the middle of winter, to take out this lord. But then they realized that was bad that they did that. And so then they had to like hunt down the sun, which was marching across the land, and defeat the sun by tricking it, essentially. And so in the aftermath of that, they were able to, it kind of like lent itself well to a kind of epilogue of them like traveling back to where they'd been staying previously, like talking about everything, like all of it kind of led into a natural storytelling kind of end with the sun literally falling. So it was like about as subtle as a hammer in some ways, but not planned for in that way.
And do you have like general advice or general tendency to end a campaign? Do you push them, like if it's not Mythic Bastion, do you push them towards like a big conflict? Do you allow for every single player to narrate their epilogue?
Yes. The second part, yes, I do. I kind of ask them, it's like, with this resolved, like, and the quest over for now, it's like, would you continue traveling together? Like, what is, like, Sir Fergal, who my friend Derek played, what's Fergal gonna do now? And then they talk about what they thought would be happening in the aftermath. in the same way that you can do in Time Passage with how did you spend the time in between ages or whatever?
The pursuits. Yeah.
I think the idea of pursuits kind of keyed them up well for that kind of like denouement.
Coming back to the city myth, how do you like the structure of it? It did remind me a little bit of the Gardens of Ying, where you have a fixed number of omens that they already have, and then you roll a die. In Gardens of Ying, you have the level that you're on, and then you roll a die, and you don't know where you end up. Is that interesting to you? Would it be better if it's just a six omen structure?
You're right. It is kind of a depth crawl. I never thought about it that way. I actually like that it's longer, because I think when you think about the Grail Quest, like throughout the Grail Quest, like Lancelot becomes like a semi-mentally ill, struggling beggar who is like a religious fanatic. You know, like you think about the things that happen to the knights in that like age transition that happens in like King Arthur's stories. Like it's enough for Mordred to grow up. Like so much time passes. So I think the idea of the city quest as a death crawl is interesting. I also think the city quest should be something that haunts the party. Like, I think if you don't know how long your campaign is going to run, like, I wonder if you could seed in early city quest stuff sooner as a way to just kind of, like, have it lurking and haunting around the edges, like some of the early first couple.
Yeah, there are, like, a few myths where it pops up. I think, like, the Manson is one where it's just, like, it's mentioned there, the river, it mentions it. So there are, like, Chris was clearly onto something, like we got to seed this here and there.
The child as well.
So I almost wonder then, if you know that you want to run the city quest, perhaps what you do is you make sure that you include some things where it is mentioned, or you find ways to work it into the stuff that you're choosing to use. Like maybe the Seeker Knights are seeking the child because, well, they are seeking the child because it will reveal the city, or it will help them find, they think the child can guide them to the city. Like that is in that one, for example.
I think that the city myth itself is pretty cool. I did run a poll on the Discord, and I was quite surprised that it's a small sample size, 25 people took part, but it was like 16 people would run it, and 9 people wouldn't.
There's a guy with a flamethrower.
So it's anachronistic. Do you think that is it?
It could be less about the contents of the city quest itself, and it could be more about people want to run an eternal campaign sometimes, and so they don't want to run an ending. And I mean, Mythic Bastion Land has a natural kind of sorrow within the game, and like, whoa, like the land is sick. The land has like has troubles.
Very Arthurian, by the way, the wasteland. And if the king is sick, then the land can't.
Yeah, big Fisher King energy. And so I think if you're going to run the city quest, it has to be seeded in. And I think sometimes people don't want to, maybe it is intimidating to people because it's like big.
One problem that I have with a city quest is with the Holy Grail, especially with a romantic view on the Holy Grail, it's almost like the unattainable thing, the thing that you cannot ever reach. It's longing for the sake of longing rather than for getting some kind of satisfaction. And that is something that I struggle with. I would almost like it to be open-ended.
I do like that it has multiple possible final omens. You know, it can go in different directions, which is a nice way to handle that aspect. I'm also kind of surprised to see that it implies this is the structure of the final myth. I'm surprised that I haven't seen anyone else create like their own version of, you know, a 20-omen myth.
Amanda, do you see yourself writing something for Mythic Bastionland?
I could. I haven't yet. Maybe now. I know there was a jam that people were running, and I thought that was very cool, but I haven't had a chance to look at what anybody wrote for it, unfortunately, because I just was like too focused on what I was doing at the time. But yeah, I think I could. But it would be hard to make sure that I wasn't stepping on Chris's toes. But I think that if anything, like writing an alternate city quest is really interesting to me, because I could see myself writing a bunch of weird omens for sure. Like I really enjoy myths and omens as a game, quote unquote, technology. Like I think they're great.
But if you were to do your own city myth, what would like the big aesthetic change be?
I think the city makes sense for Chris because I think every Bastion is the center of everything. And so it's kind of a quest for like an idealized Avalon style Bastion that's distant and unreachable to a degree. So it would need to be something that has a certain resonance for me. And so I could see it. There's this thing called the Baghdad House of Wisdom that was a kind of like a Library of Alexandria kind of mythical place. How like it existed, but it's like the Library of Alexandria wasn't everything people say the Library of Alexandria was. And I think that the Baghdad House of Wisdom, that's probably also true. Not a historian, but I would say that. But when I was briefly writing a Dungeon 23 project for, and by briefly, I mean I wrote half of it and then stopped, I would say it would probably be something around finding like a place of knowledge.
For our last segment that we love to call You Be the Judge, Brian has come up with an interesting story from his campaign. Brian, what happened?
We've reached the point in our campaign where there is some domain level play, and we've been in a holding for a while, and then the knights were setting out again to travel, and the kind of power has gone to their heads a little bit, so they're setting out with a large group. So initially, there was a traveling theater company that wanted protection on the journey, so they were coming with them. They're also bringing a war band because they're going to deal with some trouble, and they're bringing two knights that they know who are interested in being involved in that, and they're bringing a prisoner who they've been instructed to exile at the kind of border at the realm. So there was just a lot of people in this group traveling, and for me as a referee, this is kind of a question about approaches to running things. For me, I was feeling a little bit like I'm reaching the upper limits of the number of NPCs I can be dealing with. And then we started to travel. Some unusual things happened. They encountered an omen from the Legion. So this is this troublesome warband or warbands possibly traveling around. And they decided to completely change everything they're planning to do and pursue the Legion. So the Legion attacked someone and then was nearby. So like, okay, let's go looking for the Legion. They started traveling that way. There's still lots of characters around. And then they triggered a myth from the Inferno. So let me read it out, actually. Because my question is basically, what do you do with this omen? An orchard lies burned to ash. The young farmer weeps among the embers. They're left with no choice but to plead for aid at the nearest holding. So that's a relatively straightforward omen. But the extra condition here is that I, as a referee, was like, there's a lot of people here, and I don't know, do I want to have a farmer who's like, hey guys, help me with this thing. How would you like to handle that? And you can be like, you know what, I can handle any number of NPCs, that's fine.
I would say that in general, I feel very comfortable modifying an omen if I need to. But I try to keep it in the spirit of what's there. So in your case, I think something to consider is that at the point where you have a warband and you have these other folks and these like followers at this point, your knights are leading a large entourage. They would have people who are working within doing quartermaster work, doing transport, caravaner type people, managing the horses and stuff like that. So some one of them can just stick that farmer at the back of the caravan somewhere behind somebody's horse or something, but he doesn't have to become a very important NPC. But what I might do then, dialing down more into why the fire that happened to the farm is horrible, like visually and like smell and how the smoke follows you for miles, and like thinking about ways to highlight that further, like from a visceral standpoint, is something I would think about. I also would make the farmer dumbstruck in a way. You know, just like have him, like, if you don't want him to talk, make him in such shock that he is just like, all he can say is the burns, you know, or something, you know, just like you can really make him really unsettling.
When I close my eyes, I still see the flames rising.
And in them, an ancient chant. Maybe he heard chanting, like maybe something, you know?
Yeah, I like the answer that you can definitely adjust every omen to the situation. If you keep the spirit, I see these omens as story prompts. I would probably make him young and handsome enough for somebody in this gigantic entourage to be either have motherly feelings for him or more. I like the idea of, you know, relationships between, you have this gigantic blob of people, but they are still people with feelings and ideas and motivations and desires. Have them interact with a young farmer. It becomes a bit difficult. You don't want to have dialogues between two NPCs because that's awkward. Instead of having the dialogue, you can just narrate what they are doing rather than what they are saying.
I like the idea to lean into like the horror of it. The whole hex has been like burned down and his neighbor's farm is also burned down. He doesn't even know if they're still around or not. If the Nats go there, they haven't survived, and you can come across the charred corpse to like up the horror of that as well. And then I think I tell my players the likelihood of each part of your group, because I wouldn't have the farmer tag along. Since again, like that's the mental burden for me would be also substantially. He's going in the other direction and he is appalled that your knights don't want to help him, because aren't they not here to serve the realm? And then I'll probably just come up with a roll d6 for each of the elements in your party and say these people are like emotionally reacting to this person, because you said you had like two knights with you. Like one of them can peel off and go with this guy, and he's helping them, and probably something like that. And then I would tell my players that's what I do, just to expedite the whole, instead of like negotiating with each individual part of your group, and then say like they might be able to convince people of their oaths or the agreements that they've made to the knights to change the odds, either in their favor or against it or whatever. And then I'd row for it, and then essentially that's like peeling off some of them and they're going off, and then between sessions I'd work out how that's, you know, plays out.
Okay, I'll give my extremely simple outcome that I went with, was that he died in the fire. So, and they arrived there, and I feel like the heart of that omen is there has been a fire here, and it is a tragedy, and there's loss. And I feel like it's just slight, making it more extremes likely to have they find this dead farmer. The other element that they were chasing the Legion, I kind of brought that in and mingled it in a little bit, that the Legion had come through here. And maybe there's some ambiguity. Was this a fire caused by mythical things, or did the Legion burn down this farm because they're bad Legion people?
Did you, as people who have run this game, did you often have players thinking something was one thing when it was something else, in terms of like, my players kept assuming the dead were doing like things that they weren't doing, the dead myth. And so did you often experience at the table that players like their theories being very strange when it comes to the myths?
I experience very often that they are extremely confused which omen belongs to what. Yes. And they sometimes freak out and make connections that don't exist.
Yes.
Or completely mundane things, because I want the mundane things to be a bit mysterious as well. They are interpreted as myths. So yeah, I think confusion is part of the game.
Yes. I really try not to name the myth unless I have to do it. Like, they played through the whole of the Hydra, and it wasn't until quite far into it, and they'd found this old library, and they were looking through books to see, has this creature ever appeared in the past? And then I said finally, okay, here it's named as the Hydra. But until then, it was just me describing this beast, and they could refer to it however they wanted to.
Yeah.
It's great advice to show and don't tell.
I've heard a few times where on the wilderness check, I'll roll 4 to 6 and then just come up with a nature roll and come up with something that's a little bit weird. And my players dive into that as if that's one of the omens.
The question that arises, I think, from this, if there is some confusion on the part of the players, and we can call it that, but do you then say, okay, maybe this is now the myth, I'll run with this? Or do you try and stick to what's written in the book?
You can put foreshadowing into like random things. And I mean, like even like what you did with the burnt down orchid, having the two myths like come together. I've been trying to do that more and more, and I find it very rewarding because it feels more like real, like the things are really happening in the realm.
Yeah, I wholly agree. I think if you can find ways to layer mundane events and myths and also myths with other myths, like which will naturally happen from your wilderness roles a lot of the time, I think that it makes the realm feel more real for people.
Well, listeners, intersecting myths with the mundane will be the topic of our next episode. I thank Amanda P. for being a very insightful guest. And I thank all of you for listening, and I hope to see you all next time. Bye.
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 One player character who had to lick the salt from their feet because they were so devout and, you know, didn't dare to take any other salt.
That's incredible.
We'll probably cut this out, but
yeah,
that's good. That's good. Amazing.
This is the highlight of the podcast. What do you mean?